Welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Mary Beth Maziarz.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak. Every year, millions of girls around the world are forced into marriage. Among them was our first guest, Sonita Alisada, who was sold as a child bride when she was only 10 years old. But through her strength, determination, and music, Sonita escaped her destiny under the Taliban and defied the odds to become an acclaimed author, a rapper, an activist, and global advocate for women's rights.
Then we'll talk with Gidon Eshel, geophysicist and research professor known for his pioneering work at the intersection of food, agriculture, and environmental sustainability. Eshel's new book, Planetary Eating, is both a scientific investigation and a practical guide to how our daily food choices affect the Earth as a whole and some small personal actions that he says can make a big difference for the planet.
These guests, when we return, you're listening to The Mountain Life here on KPCW Park City. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Mary Beth Maziarz.
Our next guest, Sonita Alisada, was sold into marriage at just 10 years old. She was silenced before she could speak. But she fought back with her voice, her music, and her unstoppable courage. Now she's a viral rap artist, a global advocate, and Sonita turns pain into power. This is the story of how one girl escaped and changed the world with her words. It's all in her newly released book, Sonita, My Fight Against Tyranny and My Escape to Freedom. Sonita Alisada joins us now to share the gripping story of her victory and resistance. Sonita, welcome to The Mountain Life. It's wonderful to have you.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, how long have you been speaking English?
It has been since 10 years. I've been living in the U.S. So when I came in 2015, I only knew a few words in English. And fortunately, I had a roommate who was very talkative. So I learned a lot from her.
Yeah, wow. Well, you came to the U.S. as a student on a scholarship that you earned from this very viral song that you made as a rap artist. Your story is just incredible. And as I said in the intro, at 10 years old, you were sold as a child bride. Tell us more about that. I understand that marriage fell through and then you were placed on the market again for $9,000. Tell us more.
So at age 10, obviously, I didn't know what exactly it meant to be a bride, to become a wife. I was happy to receive all the attention. And for me, there were no other role models but to get married. And because we saw this happening to girls next to us, and getting married at a young age was very, people would think that you must be special or something, that they wanted to marry you. So for me, that was like a gift, kind of, even though I thought this was all a game. Fortunately, it didn't happen for different reasons. And at age 16, it was different because I knew where I wanted to be. I had role models in my life. I knew that I could be more than the tag that was put on me. And as a refugee in Iran, I had the opportunity to take classes at an NGO in Iran where they provided basic education to undocumented Afghan refugees like me. And in that course, we had a class called Dreams Book. That course taught me, many other girls, boys, how to dream and how to get to know yourself better. And I never thought I would really believe in something like that, because I was told that whatever happens to me is because of fate. We shouldn't really worry or try to change that, because it would have been impossible. So I took that class, the Dreams book, seriously after a while. And I realized that in the darkest moments of my life, it was my Dreams book that really turned me into someone who stood up against her family, against the society. Even though I loved and loved my family, but I had no choice but to stand up for myself, because I saw images of my Dreams book, and that was for me a reminder that I needed to continue. I shouldn't give up. So it helped me a lot to be who I am today.
It sounds like that class might have been completely changing the direction of your life. Because as you mentioned, sometimes our cultural messages about accepting fate or accepting your path in life might make you feel that you shouldn't do anything aside from the way that life lays in front of you. Do you think that was always within you to respond to the idea of a new possibility, or was it sparked in you by this Dreams book class?
So as a child, I was always curious to discover things, to question, even though there was my family wouldn't give me the opportunity to question more, to have responses. But when I went to Iran, I saw other girls in Iran being able to go to school, to study, to wear whatever they liked, to appear the way they wished in the society. That really inspired me that I could be someone who I want to be, not the society wants me to be. And once I had that course, it really, I don't know how everything happened, because there were so many different levels that turned me into who I am today, but it was definitely because of the dreams that I had. Before, if I was the same Sunita that I was like at age 10 or 12, I would have been okay with whatever my family decided, because I wanted to be a good girl, and that meant just obeying, learning how to cook, how to be a wife at such a young age. But my dreams turned me into a bad girl, I guess.
Well, some people might say that. Other people might have other ideas. What was your first understanding that music might be a path for you to share your experience and your truth?
So my music is the core of my story. The way I managed to escape child marriage for the second time, of course, it was because of the support I received from individuals like Rokhsar Qaim Maqami, an Iranian filmmaker, and also the professors at the NGO. They helped me a lot. And then because of my music, that I was looking for different ways to share whatever was stuck in my throat. I tried poetry, I tried pop music, and then one day I heard Eminem rapping, not even knowing what he was saying. I just felt like, I felt the anger, and I started rapping over his beats, and it felt really right to me. So I decided to use rap as a tool to share stories I wanted to speak about. So then through rap music, I created a rap song for child labor, because I was one of them. I wanted to share with other people that we missed a lot of our time to be a child. And then the next song I did professionally was Daughters for Sale. I put it together with the help of Rokhsara. I didn't expect to have more than my three fans to listen to it, but it went viral, and crazy that the next day there were it was being played on national TVs in Afghanistan. And because of that, I received a full scholarship to come to the US, to Utah, to go to school for the first time in my life.
What a wonderful story, but so surprising too, that after you came out with Daughters for Sale, which is found on YouTube. We can find it there. That the next day it was playing in Afghanistan, in Taliban-controlled, I'm assuming, Afghanistan, or that it was able to be heard and listened to there. Can you tell us how the Taliban allowed it? Because wouldn't you be sort of, you know,
so
someone
it was who... It was, the situation was a little bit better than when the Taliban were in charge. They heard it during the previous government, Ashraf Ghani, so music was allowed, which that's the reason why more people could hear me, because it was okay for rap music and especially female singers to share their work on TV. But it was at the same time very risky, because the Taliban, even though they were not in charge fully, but they were always watching out for people who spoke up and who wanted to change the harmful traditions. And there were also individuals who were not a part of the Taliban group, but they acted worse than the Taliban sometimes. So I always feared for myself, and especially for my family members in Afghanistan and relatives. But I received a lot of support, which was very shocking to me, from Afghan people as well, saying that what I was talking about is very wrong, that is still being practiced in Afghanistan. So negative and positive, they were all mixed together.
Yeah. Every year, 12 million girls are married by arranged marriages before the age of 18. And you talk about how that extinguishes a young girl's dreams and any control that she has over her own life. And this is one of the things that you're advocating for young girls, you know, not having to be forced into marriage. Mm-hmm. How has your message resonated in the world from which you came?
Before, it was very complicated in beginning 2015, because first of all, I didn't know this issue was happening even in the US. And then once I was able to share my story through the documentary Sonita and through my music, more people were aware of this harmful practice around the world. And sometimes when people would watch the documentary Sonita, they would come to me and say that I did such a great acting, not knowing that that was my life. I was not acting. What happened to me, it was real. And what happened to me is happening to a million other girls today, especially in Afghanistan, because of lack of other possibilities for girls. They cannot go to school. They cannot have public life. So what's left for them is basically marriage. That's it. And marriage kills millions of dreams. Girls, especially who have dreams of finishing their education, and they're prevented from continuing any opportunities available for them. And through my music and story, I was able to educate some people around the world. And with the help of RFK Center for Human Rights, we created a curriculum to help students around the world to learn more about child marriage. Because in most developed countries, you think that because they have more opportunities, they have more resources, they must be aware of what's going on in different parts of the world. But no, especially in the US, students are sometimes in a bubble. It feels like surprising to that in the US, kids are mostly aware of what's going on right where they are, and they don't question much. They don't know how much their voice could help other people whose voices are taken away from them, who are oppressed. So I try to help with this, and so far we have been successful in some parts to inspire students, especially to use their voices for others who need it.
Hmm.
I'd like to know a little more about how it worked for you. Did you personally feel support from your family when these opportunities and this exposure to your music started happening? Or was there some fear from them about the possible repercussions?
Whatever happened to me in Iran, in terms of the good opportunities, including the documentary and the scholarship I received, and the music that I created, Daughters for Sale, I didn't share with my families. They learned about the music video by themselves. They saw it by accident. And I wish I could. I always wanted to share all these good news with them, but it was very risky to tell them, oh, I got scholarship to go to the other part of the world, you know, to go to the U.S. because they didn't know where the U.S. is. They didn't want me to travel alone without my brothers. So I had no choice but to keep quiet, just share it with my three friends. And then when I had to leave Afghanistan, I left without a proper goodbye. And when I arrived in the U.S., I shared it with them, even though still it wasn't really exciting for them. But
it's very hard, I'm sure, any parent or family member, we always want to protect those we love, but it's interesting to figure out what to protect them from, I guess.
Right.
So I think most of your songs are in Farsi with a little Pashto, is that right?
Most of them are in Farsi and some in English. I have, if you want to share a link with your listeners, one song that's in English, it's called Run Boy. It's and my mother supported me with that song. She participated in the music video, which means a lot to me. So yeah, it's available on YouTube.
I know I was listening to some of your songs. I'm a musician too, so I was especially interested in this part of your story. Your song Stand Up has a lot of English, and I think it's sometimes hard for Americans who are very self-centered to reach beyond themselves with other languages. So I think it's wonderful that you're offering the translations and doing some of the songs. Do you find it's a different process for you writing songs that you know will be in English versus songs that are in your native languages?
For sure. When I write in Farsi, it comes easily, of course. But if I write it in English, even if the lyrics are powerful and good to go, I still feel like I could have done better if it was in Farsi because of the way words can make you feel. If you truly, if you know the language, if you know the words from your heart, it can be easier. So for me, I feel much more comfortable with rapping in Farsi. And I feel like my true emotion comes with Farsi. And English, I do it for fun. And slowly I'm getting there to feel it more and to write more in English.
You briefly mentioned, Sonita, that you attended school here in Utah. You got the scholarship, and this was high school at Wasatch Academy, which even a lot of Utahns don't know about. It's down south of Park City, where we are, and also Salt Lake in Mount Pleasant on the Wasatch Plateau, which is, it's so rural. And I'm just curious how you chose Wasatch Academy, or how they found you. How did you find each other?
I had no options. So my best and only option was Wasatch Academy. They were the only one contacted me offering the opportunity to study there. So I didn't know where Utah was in the U.S. I thought it would be somewhere like New York City. But when I landed, I was disappointed. It felt like I wasn't in the U.S., what I had seen in movies. But living in Mount Pleasant, seeing the mountains, it really helped me through the 4 years I had, reminded me of home and loved the community because it was small but very close and supportive.
I would imagine it would actually be a very good place. And then you went to college at Bard in New York. Are you still there?
No, graduated 2023.
Okay, yeah. Wonderful. And that's also a wonderful college experience. Are you able to go back to Afghanistan at all?
I went in 2016, just because I was super homesick with little English, living in the US. It was too much for me, and I needed to see my family. I went there for a week. I came back. Since then, I'm too scared to go back, especially with new projects that I'm doing. So it's too risky for me to even think of it. But I do believe that the Taliban will not always stay in power, especially with the new generation having access to the internet, having access to more knowledge to learn that they deserve a better life, and they should not be slaves under the Taliban regime. So I'm sure probably it's going to be the Taliban to change their ideology, or they have to just leave Afghanistan. Something will happen. And eventually, after my studies at Oxford, I'm hoping to be able to return to my home.
Yes, you'll be pursuing a master's degree as a Rhodes Scholar. Is that right?
That's right.
Do you know which college you'll be at Oxford?
St. John's College.
Wonderful. So Afghani women are known to be strong. It is a part of the culture in their own way, right? What kind of messages have you received from girls around the world about their own empowerment or their strength as it's maybe been affected by your work?
Especially from Afghanistan, I've received a lot of messages, not always about strength, but also about hopelessness and feeling so disappointed in international NGOs, in the international community for leaving them, abandoning Afghan women, even though they had the opportunity to become leaders, to shape the country, to create a safer place, not only for Afghanistan, but for the countries around them and eventually for every country in the world. So sometimes I receive messages from girls saying that they're very sad, they're depressed, knowing that they will no longer be able to go to school and to just hold on to the vision they had created 20 years ago. And everything that they achieved suddenly is vanished. It's very hard for them. So at this moment, I feel like most of women in Afghanistan, they're filled with hopelessness and also a spark of hope that something good might happen. That's why whenever I travel, I do speeches, I encourage people to invest in those voices that are silenced and just to carry the stories. If there is nothing happening on media, and if women are not crying and not protesting, that doesn't mean everything is okay. They're still being banned from everything that makes them a human being. So I hope that international NGOs can return, because there is no place for women in Afghanistan to shelter to and eventually do something for the longer time for the future of Afghanistan.
Well, as an average person who isn't involved with an NGO or the government, how can I support the women who are in these desperate and constrictive situations?
I mean, you guys are already helping by sharing my story and what I'm talking about, and the situation in Afghanistan. So sharing stories is very important, but if you want to do more, there's always something you could do. For example, you could use your social media again to call on your politicians. Or if you have a tool, you said you're a musician, you could use that to lend your voice. And you can also support secret schools in Afghanistan. who could benefit from even $5 per month for them to run the projects that they're doing. And those secret schools are the only sacred school, sacred place for girls and women in Afghanistan at this moment. So for us to be able to keep these places open for them, it could mean a lot for Afghan and women and girls.
Our guest is Sonita Alisada, and she's talking about her book, Sonita, My Fight Against Tyranny and My Escape to Freedom. Sonita, thank you so much for joining us today on
thank
the Mountain
Life.
Such an incredible message. Thank you.
Take care, guys.
And good luck to you in England. I hope you have a wonderful experience.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye. All right. Bye-bye.
Welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Mary Beth Maziarz.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peake. Today, we're diving into one of the most pressing, personal, and potentially impactful questions of our time. What should we eat if we care about the planet?
Joining us is Gidon Eshel, a research professor at Bard, postdoc NOAA Global and Climate Change Fellow at Harvard, and geophysicist known for pioneering work at the intersection of food, agriculture, and environmental sustainability. His new book, Planetary Eating, is out now and is both a scientific investigation and a practical guide to how our food choices affect the earth and what we can do about it. Gidon, welcome to The Mountain Life. It's an honor to have you with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, let's start with what brought you to this work. What inspired you to write Planetary Eating? Was there a specific moment that led you to explore the connection between food and climate?
Yeah. So I grew up in Israel in an agricultural commune, which is called the kibbutz. There are many of those. And I grew up in one. And kids, when they turn 13, they get to choose a part of the farm that they like to work in. And I chose the dairy farm, and I absolutely loved working there. And then as a young man, I also raised beef cattle in the Golan Heights. So farming was very close to my heart. And I chose to, when I started college, when I was 28 or so, I thought I wanted to study animal science and become a vet. But instead, I realized, oh, I really like math and physics. So I switched to that and I became a geophysicist. My PhD is from Columbia. And after some years of doing regular geophysics, I realized that one of the key ways people impact the planet, which I am busy studying, is our dietary choices. And with my colleague at the time, geophysics professor at the University of Chicago, we wrote a paper. It was, in retrospect, a humble paper, but it was a nice start. It was called Diet, Energy, and Global Warming. And it made a big splash, far more than we thought. And ever since then, really, I do a little bit still of geophysics, but mostly I do geophysics of agriculture and food. And it kind of combines my academic interest and my roots in rural part of the world, and especially animal type agriculture.
Hmm. Well, I think all the hippies remember the book Diet for a Small Planet, right? How has the idea of sustainable, you know, healthful eating for the whole wellness of the planet, how do you think that's evolved in the last 50 years?
So Diet for a Small Planet is, in my world, is a little bit like Rachel Carson. I mean, it is that prophetic, that profound, that ahead of its time. I had the honor, actually, of teaching a class with Francis Moore Lappe at Berkeley. Michael Pollan invited the two of them.
Oh.
And so I met her personally, and I met her another time in Cambridge, Mass. She's amazing. And really smart, but she's not a scientist. She has really deep intuition, brilliant intuition, but she's not a scientist, and I am. And I think I don't claim to be quite as revolutionary or as prophetic as she was, but is. She's still thankfully with us, and she has this organization, NGO in Cambridge. But I bring, I think, much more rigor. Yeah, so added rigor, added polemics, and reduced common denominator.
Yeah. If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're speaking with Gidon Eshel. He's a research professor at Bard, and he's written a new book called Planetary Eating. It's both science and just some good practical advice about how our food choices affect the planet. Gidon, I'm wondering, since you mentioned Michael Pollan, and I don't know if he was the first person to say this, probably not, but he made it popular when talking about how you should eat. He says, shop the perimeter of the store, eat whole foods, mostly green. It's such practical advice, and it's something that I always carry with me when I think about, you know, let's just keep it simple. Eat whole food, mostly green. When we're talking about our diet for planetary eating, what are those few little key points that we can keep in mind to make it simple for us when it's otherwise so complex?
Yeah, the single biggest voluntary step a person can make if they strive to improve their diet is to reduce or eliminate beef, because beef is rather negative for the human body, at least the beef that we have today. I'm not really addressing co-evolution of cattle and people in our distant evolutionary history. But right now, the beef that we have, and it really makes very little difference how it is grown. Some, but very little. Basically, the less beef you eat, the better off your body is. It also happens to be true that the less beef you eat, the lower your environmental footprint is. And that's really dramatic. The difference between two people, let's say, who eat the same number of calories or even the same amount of protein per day, but one of them derives her protein, let's say, from tempeh, and the other one the same amount of protein but from beef, those two diets will be really dramatically different in impact, depending on how much protein the person chooses to consume. It can really drop by an order of magnitude or more, a factor of 20, a factor of 50. It's kind of shocking, I think, when two people eat more or less the same diet in terms of basic measures like calories and protein and fat, etc., but one of them can exert 100 times bigger impact on the environment than her fellow eater. That sounds to me rather shocking. For example, you can't drive two cars, one 100 times better than the other in terms of emissions. We just don't have that kind of a range.
Well, maybe it's showing my age, but I remember when food labeling for ingredients and nutrition information was first instituted and how helpful it was in making dietary choices. And now we're seeing things like the carbon footprint impact scores when we book flights or look at cars. Are there any specific metrics that you would like to see available on the food we eat that would help inform everyone's ability to make better choices for the planet?
Yeah, it's a really good, important point and a good question. And I have been a consultant to several such initiatives, some by supermarket chains, etc. But each time when I deliver a proposal as to, oh, here is a labeling system that will work, they, you know, you see the corporate machinery kind of cranking in the background. And a little bit later, but universally, a polite response light, but hurt response comes, oh, thank you so much for your helpful, see you later. For your helpful input, see you later. What are they basically saying? Look, all the things that we make the good buck on, you're going to slap a red on, and all the things that we basically make maybe a penny to the dollar, you'll put a green on. What good are you? So, and I understand that. I mean, I'm not a business person, but I understand the need to make money. So it would have been really nice if there was, let's say, a USDA or some government mandate, just like producers are mandated, it's not voluntary to put the nutritional label. Likewise, to put some kind of an environmental equivalent of that. The problem, I would say, though, is that if people are going to tell me that this is too complicated, I would say, yes, you're right. It is too complicated. I'll give you an example. Let's say you go to the supermarket and you see two bins containing apples, and you look at them and they seem indistinguishable. Honeycrisp here, Honeycrisp here, both shine and look lovely and beautiful. Just sink your teeth into them. But let's say one of them came from New Zealand and the other one came from Washington State. Which one should you favor?
Oh, probably Washington State.
It's not an easy question. People may say, oh, definitely don't buy the New Zealand one. No, I would say that's not at all as simple as that. There can be many such comparisons in which buying from New Zealand ends up being the right choice to make.
Hmm. Yeah, so like a general scoring system that helps integrate all the aspects that we can't possibly manage as individuals would be helpful, but it is complex. Like, and also, is there any way to really achieve it with voluntary adherence? I mean, broad government mandates theoretically would help, but past eras have not shown government nutrition guidance to be unfettered by food lobbies and
from it.
Oh, yes. And or also even to be completely based in the most up-to-date science. I mean, I feel like every 15 years they say, oh, yeah, sorry, we had it super wrong. And now we're going to look at the science. Maybe it just comes down to the individual. Let's actually narrow it back down. As an individual, if someone's only going to listen to this next sentence, what are the few things that they should do or not do that might help us all as a planet as they eat?
Yeah. So like I said, the single biggest difference you can make is reducing or hopefully eliminating beef. That is by far step number one. Step number two, whenever possible, favor legumes and simple raw ingredients. For example, in my household, lentils and chickpeas and soy kernels are in every meal, literally in every single meal the whole day. So what's the idea here, or how can those be characterized? Think of things that you can buy in bulk, let's say chickpeas. You can buy them certainly in bulk. It is going to make extremely small overhead on that. It's very, very, you can get bulk chickpeas, let's say, for something like 80 cents a pound. It's really hard to top that. Or grains, similarly, you know, oats, let's say, people love oats. You can buy oat groats, the whole kernels, for a small fraction compared to what you would pay. Let's say if you buy Quaker oats for some reason. So I would say, whenever possible, buy legumes, pulses, beans, and such. Those are extremely good for you and extremely good for the planet. Try to buy things that were meddled with as little as possible, because that means that you get to choose what's in your food, not somebody else. Cooking at home is, you know, it's hard to top that, really.
Going back to the example of chickpeas, or I don't know when we started calling them garbanzo beans, but one's a pea, one's a bean, you know, but it's the same thing. I've got, you know, in my pantry right now, a bunch of cans of garbanzo beans. Yeah. And why do I do it? I know it's processed a whole lot more than if I were to buy them in bulk, soak them. And I still think somehow it's kind of, you know, they're pretty good for me. But and that's why I don't soak them and do that. And half the time when I do that, they go bad because I then don't eat them before they, you know, so looking at, you know, your average consumer, when I go to grab that can of chickpeas or garbanzo beans, what do I want to hear in my head, the words that you're saying right now about that choice?
I will say that if you think that you have anything to feel guilty about, I would say at least half of the year you have nothing to feel guilty about. Here's what I mean. We live in the woods in upstate New York, so we heat with a very dry seasoned wood in a wood-burning stove. And what that means is that about 7 months of the year, I cook all the beans and all the chickpeas and all the lentils and everything that we eat on that stove and allow it to cook there for 6-7 hours. And that's how long I cook chickpeas. And it's, there's no issue. I mean, this heat would have been released into the home no matter what. And all you're doing is letting that heat pass through the chickpeas first and then heat your home. Nothing wrong with that. In the summer, I, like you, choose only cans because the cooking in industrial facilities is incredibly energy efficient by comparing it to by comparison to the home cooking, and therefore I think there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. There's really nothing wrong with buying cans, period. But I would say if you really want to finesse the point, consider the seasonal consideration.
You bring up an interesting point about the historic nutritional value of our food being quite different from a lot of the foods that we see today. And some of that is genetic modification or factory farming or whatever, but some of it's just maybe heirloom seed types have been out of fashion. Like, can we improve our choices by also supporting the resurgence of some of these older forms of plant life and like an older way of doing things? Is it the old way really better?
Not necessarily. I think that this yearning for yesteryear, it doesn't really speak to me that much. For example, a simple example would be many small grains, naturally, they just dry up and fall. So we lose most of them. One of the brilliance in types of or forms of brilliance in modern agriculture is selecting. It's not genetic modification by engineering means, but simply by Mendelian selection for plants that don't just drop their seeds as evolution favored over the course of their natural history, but instead hold on to them such that when we get to them with the combine, we still have something to harvest. So I'm not that impressed with what happened in the past. In fact, many times I feel that what we have today is far superior to what we had in the past. So genetic modification is a really small portion of what we do, and it's almost entirely in a few largely useless crops like corn that people almost don't eat at all directly. We eat a lot, but indirectly by eating things that ate corn. That I would avoid at all costs, not because I have anything against genetic modification. No, I think technology is good. And technology in agriculture is very good. It's just that it keeps money in the wrong hands. In the wrong hands, I mean Archer Daniel Midland. Who needs them to make a buck? Let somebody, you know, a real business person that you can speak with and look in the eye of make money, not this diffused behemoth that you cannot have a relationship with except per the Supreme Court that corporations are persons. No, they're not. You can't have a conversation with them. It's an idiotic assertion that they are a person. I'm not weighing in on the legal merits. I'm not a lawyer.
No.
But common sense tells you that a corporation is a corporation and a person is a person. Try to make choices such that people make money, not corporations.
Yeah. Well, you bring up technology. I've been thinking since reading your book, I was thinking like people are talking a lot about the significant water use of technologies like ChatGPT and other AI engines. Should we also be more discriminating about the impact of our technological consumption for the health of the planet? I mean, I know that's not exactly the center of what you're saying, but it does relate in some ways.
No, my feeling is I use AI often, and I even wrote papers using AI that I developed with these fingers of mine. You know, in other words, wrote the code for. I have nothing against it, but what I think is quite the opposite. I think it's wonderful, but I would say use it judiciously. What I mean is, do we really need AI making for us at extravagant fossil fuel and water costs, making for us the choice of our next Netflix series or our next Spotify track? That seems to me sub-idiotic. But AI for good uses? By all means, nothing wrong with it. Quite the opposite.
Well, we have been talking with Gidon Eshel, author of a new book called Planetary Eating. This discussion is really showing us how complex the issues are and why it is great to deep dive into some of the questions that many of us have. If you're coming at keeping our planet healthy from a holistic standpoint, I think books like this can really help light the way on that path, because it is very confusing sometimes. And there's always some person in the background saying, but what about this? But what about this? And we do need people like yourself who have studied backgrounds, and you're up on the science and the metrics that actually prove this information so valuable to us. Thank you for being with us on The Mountain Life this morning, and thank you for your insights. We so appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a fun conversation.
And thanks for tuning in to The Mountain Life here on KPCW Park City. Mary Beth, you've got some great interviews coming up.
I do. I'm really excited about a few that we have coming up. We spoke with a terrific interviewee a few days ago. We taped it. Joanna Sokol, and her book is A Real Emergency, Tales from the Ambulance, and it is so entertaining. I thought it was going to be, I don't know what I thought it was going to be.
Maybe gory.
Gory, or like a little bit of like adrenaline rush that you imagine from shows like 911 or whatever. But she really goes into how different the job of a paramedic or an EMT is than many of us think, and also some of the crazy stuff she has seen, which is just hilarious. And we also have a couple of people who are about workplace stuff, the emotionally intelligent team, about how to be more in tune with others in your workplace. And that can be anything, whether you're working with a club or a school or any kind of structured environment. And then also one called That Was Fun, a book about work by Bree Groff, about just keeping the workplace fun. And who doesn't want to do that? I think that's always a good time.
That's right.
Yeah. Have fun like we do here.
We have a lot of fun here. We really do. And then we've got some stuff for Grandparents' Day. So it's going to be great.
Celebrating Grandparents' Day. Love it. Okay, stay tuned. Now, the conversations you've heard here this morning and the insights you hear on all of our public affairs shows are made possible because of listeners like you. Listener support is the largest and most reliable source of funding for KPCW. As you now have likely heard, funding for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting was just eliminated by Congress, including a $264,000 grant that KPCW was set to receive. This means a major budget shortfall for the station, and we're in the midst of an emergency fundraiser to raise an initial $100,000 by Sunday.
So far, we've raised just over $50,000 since Friday. You have the power to make a big difference right now. If you've never given to KPCW before, now would be a really, really good time to start. Or if you typically donate once a year, could you consider making an additional gift now? Better yet, start a monthly recurring donation to provide a sustained and steady stream of support that we can rely on. And we have a challenge from a generous donor, Damian Lee, who has offered to match up to 12 new Broadcaster Club members at the $1,000 level. So if you've thought of joining, now is really the time. You can do all this right now at kpcw.org and help us reach $100,000 by Sunday.
And we absolutely appreciate and need your support.